warm greetings from Miami, Florida.
Fahrenheit, that was 80 degrees and sunny for the whole weekend in Boca Raton. Short sleeve shirt, you know. Ah, machaya. But I got back to New York on Sunday, so Monday was particularly wintry. I saw my first snow flurry in New York City on Monday. Nothing to... I told my family there, I said, Yerushalayim, we would have closed school for 2 days. Just for a zecher of a flurry. But even though in Fahrenheit, only 37, which is above the freezing, but the wind chill made it about 24, 25. It was very cold, considering that just the day before it was 80. So that was a startling shock. Okay. Baruch Hashem, Elal was kind enough to bring me home yesterday, and yeah. Very, if you read the Jerusalem Post today, they're making some progress with the negotiations with the pilot union, and hopefully things will get back to normal, and so on. But it was inconvenient for some people, and we managed.
They made a big profit last quarter.
What? Last quarter?
A substantial profit.
Yeah, but they made profit because the gasoline price went, the Delek went down. That's why. Yeah, no, it's true.
That's true. You're right.
That's why they made. Yeah.
So right. It doesn't matter at all anymore.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, the page that we used last week, Tariag Mitzvot Minatoa Minayin, we're still on that page. There are plenty on the back there for those that don't have. On the second side, towards the bottom of the page, and for some reason or another, I erroneously didn't number the last two sources, but they would actually be source 9 and 10. So the source that's after number 8 would, in essence, be source 9. Sfat Emet. Sfat Emet, as you know, is the Rebbe of Gur, the second Rebbe of Ger. The first was his grandfather, Rav Yitzhak Meir, popularly known as Rav Itcher Meir, or the Chidushei HaRim. Rim is Reish Yud Mem, Rabbi Yitzhak Meir, and hence in the Gera dynasty families, there are plenty of Yitzhak Meirs there, popularly known as Ichamaya. The Ichamaya, right. But his grandson was the successor, and he was known as the Sfat Emet. He died in 1904. Sfat Emet wrote this very, very beautiful Perush on the Chumash that's used popularly not only in the world of Gera Chassidim, but every Bnei Akiva Madrich always takes a peek at it also, because there's some wonderful ideas. He was clearly not a card-carrying tzioni, but had so many beautiful things to say about our relationship to Eretz Yisrael that makes for good talks to audiences of all ages. For example, most probably his most towering thought about Lech Lecha was that the question was, what did Avraham Avinu do right that HaKadosh Baruch Hu turned to him and said, Lech Lecha? The Ger Rebbe said, the Sfat Emet, says, no, HaKadosh Baruch Hu announced it to the whole world, except Avraham was the only one who paid attention. It's a very, very good idea. Very good idea. Because I use this in the context of our meeting our brethren in Chutz La'aretz. So, you know, why did some of us have the fortune of understanding that maybe we should leave the Gola for whatever reasons, and those, you know, haven't yet achieved that understanding? And the answer is that some people hear the call of Lech Lecha and some people don't. But HaKadosh Baruch Hu is calling out to everybody, not just to Yechidei Skula, the special people. They're calling out to everybody. It's a very, very nice word. Here, the Sfat Emet is dealing with our subject, the subject of the 613. And going back 51 years to my own bar mitzvah, and that's going to be exactly in a week's time, 51 years from my bar mitzvah. You can do the math and figure out the rest. If you need a calculator, I can help you out. So, I daven mincha in the senior citizen's home where my mother-in-law, she should be blessed till 120, and she's actually going to make it. She's really doing great. So by mincha, between mincha and marav, they made a birthday party. They said a three-year-old. So my son was with me, one of my sons was with me. He says, what, there's a kid here? No. It was somebody who was 103. So one, okay, it was very nice. They brought a cake and they sang. It's very nice. And the man has all his marbles. I mean, the man is about Kyrie there and a really terrific person. So a gentleman there said, somebody said, how old is he? So a guy says he's 106. Another person says, no, he's 103. All machloikas, how old? I mean, all you have to do is go over to a fellow and ask him, right? So this fellow who's insisting that he's 106 says, no, we were waiting online for food yesterday, and he told me specifically that he was born in 1913. And therefore he's 106. So another man comes over and says, no, he was born in 1813. So I looked at the guy and he says, that makes him 202. I mean, no, oh, you're right. Like, I mean, there's a reason why some people are there. It was so funny, the whole thing. But he was 103, and Baruch Hashem, and they wished him also to 120, and they also said something to the effect of that, you know, they'll be all around to celebrate his 120th birthday. So at Bar Mitzvah, when Bar Mitzvah boys get to put on tefillin, so you know, you do something very new, very novel, and you're taught to open up the siddur, and you open up, and you see that before the brachot, there are all kinds of tefillah, before the tefillah, yiratzons, and after. By the time the fellow's 14 years old, he's doing like every other adult. Just thank God he's still putting on his tefillin and with a bracha, and that's where it begins, that's where it ends. Nobody's saying the yiratzons before and after any longer. But I do recall some of the passages of the yiratzon, and one ended with V'taryag mitzvot hatluyot ba. And if we ask Kadosh Baruch Hu, they should accept this mitzvah of tefillin that we're performing right now, along with the 613 that are linked to this mitzvah, linked to this mitzvah. And to this end, the Sfat Emet has something very interesting to say. In the source that will be essentially after number 8, so we'll call it 9, Sfat Emet, Likutei Shelot U'Tshuvot, Siman Aleph. And he says, U'mashe Katuv V'Nusach, and that which is printed or written in the version of this tefillah, Taryak Mitzvot HaTluyin Ba, and the 613 that are dependent on this one mitzvah that I'm fulfilling, da lecha, you shall know. The taryag mitzvot hem haklal. 613 is the general number. V'chol mitzvah u'mitzvah miyuchedet b'fnei atzmo. And each mitzvah is at the particular. Ach haklal tzarich liprat. The sum is equal to the whole is equal to the sum of its parts. And therefore, lechein, taryag mitzvot truyin b'chol mitzvah u'mitzvah. In order to have the totality of Taryag, you have to have the detail of every individual mitzvah. Which means that if you're delinquent in one particular mitzvah, the whole message of Taryag collapses. Because it's not that it's just limping, but it's going to collapse. It's a building that's based upon 613 foundations. And if you pull out a particular foundation, the balance of what Torah is all about is going to collapse. And I can prove that the Torah was interested in a balance. Because two of the mitzvot, and they are part of the 613, but not just part of the 613. The Rambam has elevated them to two of the 13 principles of faith, tenets of faith of the Ani Ma'amin. One is, we're not allowed to add to what the Torah has ordained. And one is not allowed to delete. So the addition and deletion, known as Bal Tosif and Bal Tigra, mentioned twice in the Chumash, both in Sefer Dvarim, one in Parshat Vetchanan, one in Parshat Re'e. But the reason it's mentioned twice is because there are two different sides to this. One is not to add numerically to the number 613, according to the Rambam, and not to delete from the number 613. So you can't come along and say that lighting Hanukkah candles is now mitzvah number 614 in the list. That's Bal Tosif. And yet you can't come along and say that the prohibition of Shatnez is now delete, push the delete button, and we only have 612. Those are violations of Bal Tosif and Bal Tigra. You can't do that. But the Rambam says goes further. He says within the context of a mitzvah, you can say, all right, listen, I like the mitzvah of the Arbat Minim. I think it's very, very nice. But I would like to add a banana to as a fifth species because I happen to like bananas. I would never do that because I don't like bananas. But I could put something else there. But you can't do that. It's four species and not five. And you cannot say, look, there's a beautiful medrash about the Arba Minim. The Etrog is the fragrance and the taste that represents the Tzaddik who has the Torah, the Masim Tovim. And the Tamar, the date palm branch, has taste, no fragrance. It's a Jew who may have Torah knowledge, but lacking in performance. And then there's the Hadas that has fragrance and not taste. That's the Jew who may be ignorant, yet he performs properly. And then this Arava, which is neither tam nor reach, neither fragrance, nor taste, and it's a person who does not have any Torah knowledge and no performance as well. So the person will say, look, I'm fairly willing to identify with a Jew who has something, at least some Torah, some Asim Tovim, but a person who has nothing, the Arava Jew, I don't want to have anything to do with him, so I'll just take the Etrog, the Hadas, and the Lulav. The answer is, you don't have 3/4 of a mitzvah. You have 0 of a mitzvah. Not only that, but you get the Avera of Bal Tigra. You're taking away from a detail in the mitzvah. Or if you take, for example, the details of mitzvah tefillin. So you say, of course I agree with the mitzvah tefillin, but why 4 parshiot? I'd like to stick in a 5th. My parshat ha-shavua for my bar mitzvah, for sentimental, it's a nice idea, no? For sentimental value, person sticks in a 5th parsha. That's forbidden. That's Baal Tosif. You can't do these things. So you see that what the root of Baal Tosif and Baal Tigra is the upset of the balance of Torah. Torah has to be perfectly balanced. So the Rambam is well aware, keenly aware of this, with regard to rabbinic add-ons. Are not rabbinic add-ons, both in the positive and the negative, the takanot and the gzerot, upsetting the balance. So the Rambam says, they surely can upset the balance, and therefore, in order to have a successful integration into Jewish life of takanot and gzerot, there has to be some, in a sense, education and propaganda, ta'amula, to go along with it, that people have to understand the rationale of why we're doing this. You're doing the mitzvah of Hanukkah to really express the Shevach V'Hodah HaKadosh Baruch Hu, but you have to make it perfectly clear, this is a rabbinic add-on, it's not a Doraita, and if it's a Issa Muktzah on Shabbat, you have to understand why the Torah, why the Chachamim moved the boundaries a little bit further to protect us from falling into the trap of the Avera in a biblical sense. So if it's all doctored up properly, if it's all packaged, it's all in the packaging. If you package it properly, you advertise it to Am Yisrael properly, that they should not make the mistake that this might be a deoraita, biblical infraction, then there's no prohibition of Baal Tosif or Baal Tigra. And without that, Rambam says, we're liable to fall into the trap, and that would be a violation. So balance is very, very important. I remember discussing, it's one of my lectures that I like to give, Does Chumrah Make for a Better Person, for a Better Jew? That's the title, Does Chumrah Make for a Better Jew? So my wife told me, look, you know the answer is no, let's move on to the next topic. I said, yeah, but I get paid to say that in 45 minutes, you know. You have to develop it, you have to show that the Chumrah doesn't necessarily make you into a better Jew. It can make you into a better Jew. There's room for Chumrah in Torah life. But that doesn't mean pile on the chumrah and you automatically get a few extra brownie points. Because as the Rav Zichron LeBracha taught us, just as in physics, every action has a reaction. Right? Anybody ever shot an M16 gun, felt it in the shoulder because of recoil? So that's a fact of physics. So too, he said, every chumrah has a kula at the other end, a leniency, which means if you're going to be excessive about a particular area of halakha, in all likelihood, you're going to be paying a price on some other end. Not always are you aware of what that price might be. And that price might be very high and not worth the chumrah. And the Rav said, before you engage in adopting chumras, he says you should weigh carefully what the repercussions are. And the repercussions can be very, very severe. I'll give you a very, very clean example where I'm not going to tell you, you know, how to handle it, because I think each individual case could be different and it has to do with sensitivities of people. But I have encountered boys and girls who've come to Israel to study for the year, and they've taken on all kinds of chumras for whatever reason, usually because the school tells them which hashgachas to eat and which hashgachas not to eat, even though they may not even have a clue what's the difference in any of the hashgachas. But these are politically correct things to say in certain schools, and identifies them. And then they get invited by some great aunt for Shabbos, and all of a sudden, you know, they can't eat there. They can't eat this and they can't eat that. And, you know, this great aunt is extremely insulted because she thought all her life she was keeping a kosher home. And here comes this boy or girl studying in a school in Yerushalayim, you know, a whole 17 and a half, 18 years old, and is telling this great aunt, you know, what to do and what not to do and so on. I said, listen, you know, the in Baba Kama, with regard to the factor called boshet, which means paying for embarrassment if somebody gets injured, you know, it's not a nice thing to walk around with a black eye in public, so that's worth money also, compensation. So it says, with regard to Hakol Lefi HaMevayesh VaMidbayesh. It's all dependent upon who's doing the embarrassing, who's receiving the embarrassment. It's a very subjective call. Because, you know, if a four-year-old yells an insult at you, all right, you don't have to take it so personally. It's not like the story of the two kids coming out of shul after Yom Kippur, and one little kids, and one says to the other, he says, yeah, the chazan this year wasn't worth anything. And the chazan happened to have passed by, and he overheard it, goes home, and he cries to his wife. He says, yeah, I gave my whole kishkas out for the whole davening Yom Kippur. That's what the kids have to say. It wasn't worth anything. So the wife tells him, don't take it seriously. Kids only repeat what they hear from parents. So Hakol Lefi HaMevayesh VaMidbayesh, it all has to do with who's doing the embarrassing and so on. We once had a scenario here in Shalayim where nephew was here studying for the year in some yeshiva. And it was a year that we made bar mitzvah for one of our kids. We were living in a remote. And for sure, he was invited. And he came to our house as a guest and brought his own chicken. I mean, you know, I was only the rav in the community. That's all. But my wife was insulted. But I tell you the truth. I said, it's not even his fault. It's the whole system's fault. Something's wrong out there. Something's wrong. Mamash. But this is exactly what the rav is talking about. That you want to have a chumrah in shechita and this and that. Okay, beseda. But that doesn't mean that what the other person's eating with a heksher is treif. And you have to understand that. There were Gdol Yisrael who really, really understood that. Who understood it wholeheartedly. And said that when you in your house do whatever you want. You're a sovereign power, a master of your house. But when you eat out, so consider the sensitivities. That doesn't mean eat treif. It means, you know, you don't have to go along with every chum in the book when somebody else may not have that, but essentially the Shulchan Aruch says it's kosher. Yeah.
There's a wonderful line, I think it's in Gemara, maybe you can tell me. Yeah.
What was that?
Kadesh
Atzmecha b'mutter lecha is used in the context of don't excessively put on stringencies. I'm trying to remember what the exact sugya, whether it was in the Dorim or I have to just backtrack a little bit where it's from. But that's usually the context that it's used. But here it's excessive. Look, I say again, you're allowed to add on whatever you want in your private life, but you have to be careful when it starts impacting on others.
Is the famous issue about salvation about the Shmiras Shabbos and the Pikuach Nefesh. So, Rav said, you have to be, I have a chumrah on Pikuach Nefesh and that.
Okay, that he said in the name of his grandfather, Rav Chaim from Brisk, who said that somebody asked him, how come you're so lenient with Shabbat issues? Because a lot of times things were happening that were quasi-emergencies, and Rav Chaim was very quick on the draw to say, he can do this and he can do that. And they asked him, why are you so lenient? He says, he's machmir on pikuach nefesh. So sometimes the very same shayla is really a double-edged shayla, and depends how you're going to view it. And that's quite correct. It's a good example. But many times we don't see what's on the other end. That's what the Rav was cautioning. You don't see the flip side. And therefore, he said you have to be very, very careful on how to deal with a life of chumrah. So here we have balance. I brought this all out because the term balance is important. And 613 is the totality, and there's 248 do's and 365 don'ts. And the Sfat Emet here says that each detail is really a particular to create the sub, the total. And without that particular, the total is delinquent, and it's going to collapse. So that's very important. I have another understanding of the Taryag Mitzvot HaTliyot Ba, which I think is equally valid, and that is a borrowing from the world of genetics. So we know that when studying cellular biology, and I had a particularly good teacher in YU for cellular biology, it was Rabbi Moshe Tendler, you know, he knew that we weren't really science majors, so whatever was on Rav Moshe Feinstein's desk that afternoon, that's what we were taught the next day. If it had something to do with science, like in 1971, heart transplants and other things, it was a great class. It was really a super class. So Rabbi Tendler taught us cellular biology, and there you discover that every cell of the body that has differentiated into particular areas of the body, whether it's skin cells, whether it's muscle cells, whether it's cardiac cells, whether it's brain cells. It all started out as an embryonic state, and it had the genetic code of the parents. And of course, you know, there's recessive and dominance and so on. And then ultimately, the newborn assumes some of the character of the father, of the mother. Ve'ele todot Yitzchak ben Avraham. Avraham hulid et Yitzchak. Which the Torah, that's almost a ridiculous phrase. And here's the history of Yitzchak, the son of Avraham. Avraham gave birth to Yitzchak. You just said, Ve'ele todot Yitzchak ben Avraham. So Rashi has something to say about that. Everybody does. But what really Chazal was saying was that Yitzchak was a spitting image of his father. And there was a whole issue, you know, with the story of Avimelech that we read about in the parasha. So, you know, who knows, you know, what the deal was in terms of Yitzchak. So it was clear the father was Avraham. Avraham holded at Yitzchak. Because there's a certain genetic makeup that allows that the son, the exterior complexion is going to be almost identical. That's not identical, but similar, very similar to the parent or one of the parents. Fine. So that we know, and we know that today when we're doing all kinds of genetic research and the ability to create human tissue and then ultimately the ability to create a human body, we're only years away from that, by the way. I mean, if you talk about the sheep, the Dali, and so on, that they've done it already with animals, and if they did it with animals, they can do it with human beings as well. It's only a question of time. And Rabbanim have already begun talking about the situation. What would this halachic status of such a person, if you can call him a person, would he be the everybody goes back to the Maral from Prague and talks about the Goylem, and what would be the status of the Goylem? I mean, is it human, is it animal, and all kinds of implications, a zillion implications. So many of the poskim are pretty scared about this kind of genetic research. But one thing is clear, forget about making human body out of genetic material, but if a person can read the genetic material, and that's not a theoretical comment. Geneticists can read the genetic material. They know what a chromosome looks like. They know what a DNA structure looks like. They know what an aberration in the DNA looks like, and they can say which particular gene has caused this particular deformation in a baby, a mental state, a psychiatric state, a physical state. We know these things today. And you don't have to have tons of genetic material. All you need is a cheek cell. All you need is a skin cell. You need one cell that you can extract the genetic information from, and it's going to tell you whether that person had blue eyes or brown eyes, whether that person had black hair or brown hair. That's what it's going to tell you. If you can read it, it's going to tell you if that person has a disposition to anger or not. That's right. There's also, people get angry. But how come some person blows up at the smallest thing, and the other person, easy. So there's a lot of training in that too, no doubt. But there's also genetic disposition too, character traits. We know that as well. So if a person has a disposition to have a low boiling point, that doesn't mean it's mutter, it's permissible for him to explode at everything. That means he's got to work on it. He's got to work on character building and behavioral modification a little bit better than perhaps others in that particular area. Doesn't mean he's exempt. So you can't hide behind it and say, what do you want from me? It's the genetics, you know. I couldn't help myself. I had to punch the guy. No, you can't say that. You have to train yourself not to punch the guy. So just as the gene, the DNA in the cell has the genetic code of the entire organism, so too every single individual mitzvah carries with it the spiritual DNA of all the 613. Of all the 613. And how does that express itself? I think an individual like the Lubavitcher Rebbe, Zechariah Lebracha, understood this well. He really did understand it well. That when it comes to kiruv, to trying to bring somebody back into the fold, who either was born in a secular family or left the fold and trying to bring him back, you cannot educate by giving an avalanche of all the mitzvot. That's not going to work. But to start with one mitzvah at a time. And the truth is, our Rebbe, the Rav Zechariah Lebracha, had the identical opinion And in questioning with regard to, it was a very practical case. You know, there were many, many children, Jewish children who went to public school in the States who were given at least some type of afternoon Hebrew school education. And then some of these shuls also had junior congregations. The question was, if the child's going to be driven to shul on Shabbat to attend the junior congregation, is that something that you, as a Shomer Torah Mitzvot, can encourage that child to attend the junior congregation when you know fully well it's going to involve some measure of Chilul Shabbat? That if you wouldn't have said anything, not that the father would have been a Shomer Shabbos, but at least that particular drive he would not have taken. And he's driving to shul because you encouraged his son to go to shul on Shabbat. Rav Moshe Feinstein has a tshuva, is clearly forbidden because of Misayeya L'Dvar Avira, you become an accomplice to the crime. But the Rav had a different opinion. He asked me point blank. He says, what are you trying to accomplish with this encouragement? Are you trying to encourage davening, tefillah, or shmirat Shabbat? Because the figuring was, at least in the shul, when he's there for an hour or two, there's some semblance of the spirit of Shabbat. So I clearly, immediately said, I'm trying to encourage tefillah. Why? Because the feeling was that those kids that felt comfortable in the junior congregation, we had a better shot at encouraging them later to join the NCSY Shabbatonim. I overheard kids saying that those who did not like to go to shul, so they heard at NCSY Shabbat, it was all day in shul, it was boring, it was that. But those kids that did, you know, turn on to the davening part, were more likely to attend later, maybe another year or two or three, some type of NCSY Shabbatonim. And that then the ball was already in motion. The person could become closer to Shmirat HaMitzvot. And that's what the Rav said. He said that if you think Tefillah is what you're focusing on, so he says, just put Shabbat on the side, on the back burner, he said. Put Shabbat on the back burner. Now you're not worried about Shabbat. Now you're worried about Tefillah. And just focus on that. He says, when it comes to Kiruv Levavot, he says, it's not a package deal. I mean, ultimately it's a package deal. But now the strategy is one mitzvah at a time. Because from the power of each mitzvah can sprout all of Torah. And the Rabbi Sherebbe understood this, the Rav understood this, and so on. I mean, there was another example that we had with regard to encouraging kids who are attending various youth groups, and you could teach them something about saying brachot, knowing fully well that as 6th graders and 7th graders, they're still eating non-kosher at home. And the halacha is, if you eat non-kosher, you're not allowed to make a bracha. So should you encourage them to make brachot, yes or no? And the Rav said yes, to encourage them to make brachot, because, all right, as a 6th grader, the kid can't make a revolution in the kitchen yet. But don't worry, when he's in 11th grade, he's going to make a revolution about every other thing in the house, because he's an adolescent. Let him make the revolution on kashrus also. So that will happen later on. Meantime, he's training himself to make brachot. So that, the Rav had great vision and foresight in this area, but it was all based upon the fact that each mitzvah carries the genetic code of every mitzvah in the Torah, and you never know where you can release the power of the other mitzvot. The Rav said it in context of doing tshuva as well. That's why he says, the Rambam tells us in L'chot Tshuva Paragimel, that as Seret Mei Tshuva, we should have a program of escalated mitzvah performance. Because you don't even know which mitzvah is going to do it. That's the famous idea of the Vilna Gaon. Why keep the minhag of the Rama of delaying Kiddush Levana till after Yom Kippur? We should actually do it before Yom Kippur. Who knows? Maybe that's the mitzvah that's going to tip the scale here, and it'll be a waste to wait till after Yom Kippur. Yeah.
The Rama also said that it's forbidden to go into a conservative synagogue That's correct.
That's a different issue. That's a completely different issue. First of all, the Rav allowed going into conservative institutions to teach. Even Rav Moshe Feinstein did that for teaching Torah, 100%. And he said that so long as you're not being dictated to teach the theological ideas of conservative reform, but if you have a free hand to teach what you want to teach, then it's perfectly not only legitimate, but it's okay. There, the Rav was fighting the whole institution of the shul of the conservative movement, and he said that even, forget about going inside the shul, the Rav Paskin, they're allowed to stand outside and hear the shofar from the window from a conservative shul. He says, better not hear the mitzvah at all, and just instead of granting some measure of recognition. You have to realize that this was a battle that the Orthodoxy was carrying on against the Reform, but more the conservative movement, who were really representing the Jewish community up until after World War II, and then had a lot to do with the Rav giving legitimacy to modern Orthodox Judaism, that modern Orthodox Judaism really took off and became a power to be reckoned with in the United States. Just in a conversation just the past Sunday afternoon with my brother in New York City, so we talked about certain of these issues, and he said that the Rav was living, you know, when he was living in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, saying things that he was very, very concerned and worried about imitating things that were going on in other, let's call it, denominations. But today, the feeling is that we've won these battles already, or these aren't even battles anymore. For example, Machitza. Once upon a time, that was the issue. Who didn't write a tshuva on the height of Machitza? Every Rav that was worth anything wrote a tshuva on the height of Machitza. Today, no Rav even deals with it anymore. In Orthodox shuls, people understand that there is a Machitza, and they understand that there's a requisite height. These things are already a given. Nobody's really fighting it, you know, the way it was in 1958, where there was a suit in some state in Michigan, I think, and the Gdol Yisrael had to write all kinds of tshuvas to a state Supreme Court as to the... There's a book called The Sanctity of the Synagogue. It assembled, put together all these tshuvot.
It was in Ohio.
It was in Ohio, okay. So wherever it was. But today, that battle is behind us, essentially. It doesn't mean here and there you still don't have skirmishes, but the battle is behind us. So today, Rabbanim can perhaps look somewhat differently. The issue that I talked about, my brother, had to do with Simchat Torah and women issues with Simchat Torah. So it's true that the Rav said what he said, you know, 25, 30 years ago, but that was in a context of 25, 30 years ago. And it's not that the halakha changed, but the world has changed, and our attitudes have changed. And therefore, it's possible that we could live with a somewhat of a different psak halakha today, because that which the Rav said 30 years ago wasn't halakha l'moshe m'Sinai. It was something that he felt was correct at that day, and perhaps this could be adjusted. And you might think, wow, this sounds like Reform Judaism already. It's not so. I'm just digressing for a second, but just so you should understand the point. I have a little sideshow that I study Jewish art, and that I give all the credit to the Emunah Women organization that brought me into the Emunah College back in the 90s. And there I got into Jewish art. I taught Jewish art at Bar Ilan University. So when you study synagogue art, you go to certain old synagogues, even excavated shuls here in Eretz Yisrael, or old shuls of Europe, and there are still shuls 600-700 years old, and you see the artwork on the walls and so on, with pictures, with figures and so on. Nobody in a million years today would design a shul with those kind of figures that they did years ago. But then you see lapses, you see ups and downs, certain periods. For 100 years, you see more of these pictures, and then 100 years less of these pictures. And then you do a correlation. Those areas and those countries where Jews were subject to more persecution, you see a stringency in figure arts in shuls, which means the artistic styles usually are borrowed from the neighborhood, from the outside, and contact with the outside has a lot to do with the overall general atmosphere of the relationship between Jews and the outside world. And if the relationship was sour, the Jews closed their doors and sealed themselves and so on. They want to have nothing to do with the outside world. Then you see a decline in synagogue art. And in those areas where you see more religious freedom, there you see the poskim, not just saying what you see in reality, which is true, but if you check the poskim and how they poskim in those days, it also reflects this more liberal atmosphere. And that shows that sometimes these piskei halacha, these decisions, aren't really absolute, but they're relative to a particular context and have to be understood as such. And that's very, very important. That's a very important piece of information, by the way. Okay, so that's the Sfat Emet. And now just take a look at the last source, which essentially would be source number 10, and then we're going to get back to source number 5 that I promised you last week. Ralbag. Who's the Ralbag? He's a Parshan. He's a commentator to Tanakh, to Chumash and Davi, Rabbi Levi ibn Gershon. In English, he's referred to as Gersonides, like Maimonides. Gersonides, that's how he's related to in the research literature in English. But his name is Ralbag, and we have rabbinic family Ralbag right here in Yerushalayim, and they are descendants of the Ralbag. So Ralbag lived in Ashkenaz, and what's very unique about Ralbag, that as opposed to all the Sfaradi commentators, not all, but most, it was very common, the Sfaradi Gedolei Yisrael of the Middle Ages were also scientists. That's not a chiddush. The Rambam was a philosopher. And when you say scientist in the Middle Ages, what you're saying is what we use in the language of the dining room, a kolboinik. You know what a kolboinik is? It's just the bowl that you put all the garbage in. It means it's jack of all trades, it's everything. It's not like today where everything has become so highly specialized, let's say in medicine. Although there are some doctors who are going back to the concept of holistic medicine and really seeing the whole picture. Because the truth is, you do have to see the whole picture. Remember, one of my sons, today he's a pilot, but then he was experimenting, jumping off for things when he was a kid in school. So he broke his elbow and he broke his fingers and Baruch Hashem, you know. So we took him to Kupat Cholim here in Yerushalayim. So he had to have x-rays, beside the x-rays on a finger. So we're waiting and waiting and waiting, and everybody else is there, is getting the results and waiting. And finally, I go over to the desk, I ask the Kida there, what's going on? Well, the radiologist who looks at hands is not here. It's just the radiologist who looks at feet. I said, make sure, I want a radiologist who just looks at pinkies, you know, like, you're telling me the radiologist that can tell you if the foot is broken can't tell me if a finger's broken? I mean, the whole thing was teruf, you know, like, it's crazy. You have to have a radiologist just for hands. You know, in those days, if you were an astronomer, you were also a mathematician, you were also a musician, you were also a doctor, you were also a philosopher. You were everything. That's called science. If you were Ishmada, you were all of the above. You were just knowledgeable. Because later on, the knowledge became so heavy that people had to specialize in particular areas. So in Svard, in Spain, there were many of the great Torah thinkers who were also Kolbeinics. They were also great in the general studies. But in Ashkenaz, that wasn't the case. Rashi, Rabbeinu Thomas' grandson, they were not noted to be astronomers or philosophers or anything like that. They were busy growing grapes, and they were selling wine. They were soichrim, they were business people. That's what they did. And so to say that we have now an example of an Ashkenazi who was a scientist, Ralbag, that's a big chidush, that's a novel idea. And he was very, very, very special. My daughter, Ahuva, she did a doctorate on Ralbag at the Bar Ilan University, so she can lecture here from today till Yomot HaMashiach about the Ralbag. So Ralbag, and she pointed out to me this, by the way, this source, I would not have known it on my own, she pointed out to me that Ralbag challenges the whole idea of 613 as being from Sinai, which means he takes the Rambam to task. We've seen to it last week, the Rambam believed that the number 613 was axiomatic. It was something that was traditional from Sinai. What the Rambam does not have is an exact listing. So he proposes a list. The Ramban, Rabbi Moshe ben Nachman, actually opens up the whole issue to discussion and concludes that the Rambam's right. The number 613 is from Sinai, except that his list is a little bit different. But at least the number is from Sinai. The whole reason that the issue became an issue is because before the Rambam, whether it was the Halachot Gedolot of the 7th century, whether it was Rabbi Sadigon of the 10th century, and started including rabbinic mitzvahs like Hanukkah and Purim into the list of 613, suggested that the number 613 is not from Sinai. But the Ralbag, who's after the Rambam, he challenges this whole thing, and he says that the number 613 is approximate. What do you mean approximate? If you take a look at that source, the last source on the page on the second side, it's not numbered, but essentially it would be number 10. Hinei hit ba'er lanu. Heyot ba'elu ha-misparim shezachar Rav Simlai, k'sat kiruv, which means mispar lo meduyak, that which we learned last week, the drasha of Rav Simlai. And he says, Torah tziva lanu Moshe. Torah, tab vav reish hei, is the gematria 611. And the tradition is that Moshe Rabbeinu taught Am Yisrael 611 mitzvot. But two of the mitzvot we heard directly from HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Anoch Hashem Elokecha, and Lo Yir Lecha Le'imachem Alpanai. So 611 plus 2 is 613. Melamed Shedinu Tariag Mitzvot Le'Moshe V'Sinai. May you see that the 613 is from Sinai. So Ralbag says, that which is mentioned in the Drasha of Rav Simlai, Ktzat Kiruv, Mispar Lo Medunyak, it's not exactly 613. Lo Chashash Bar Rav Simlai Bazeh Hadrash, he wasn't so concerned in giving this great drasha, even if the number, the final number, was off by a few. V'ze kemo sheyotzi bedrash pasuk echad mikavanato lotzi mimenu musar tov. It leads to a very, very nice ethical thought. And therefore, don't bother me with the facts that it doesn't really add up to 613. Kein heikal me'od me'at ze hachacham v'ze hamispar. So the chacham, this Rav Simlai, so I'll use a little colloquial. He faked it a little bit. That's all. Lotzi mimenu elu ha-musarim ha-niflaim she'yatzu me'elu ha-misparim. He wanted to deduce some beautiful ethical ideas from this number. Ke'ilu kol eva ve'ever me'evrei adam yomar asei b'mitzvah. Because he divided the 613 into two portions, 248, which corresponded to the limbs of the body. That's a nice drasha. V'chol yom v'yom mimot hashana hamshim shit. And the days of the year, of the solar year, which is 365, as if each day is saying, al tavor bi'avira, don't do an avera on this day. So it's a beautiful drasha, he says. U'be'yot ha'inyan kein, and if the totality comes out close to this number of the totality of the days of the year 635 and the limbs of the body, that's enough. I've done a job by deducing the ethical idea. It doesn't have to really be on the nose, 613. It could be, as we say in Hebrew, plus minus. Plus, minus, on each side. One thing I can tell you, Rabach didn't write this in Frankfurt. In Frankfurt. They would never have tolerated. The word be'erich doesn't exist in the German language. It's pünktlich. Pünktlich means precisely, not before and not after, and so on. And here, Rabach comes along, and he's speaking like a 100% Galiziana. Yeah, pchot yoter, it's berach, all right, it's berach. Now, we don't have to be so picky, on the exact number here. And he goes on to say that he can live with the drasha of Rav Simlai on this. That's the real chiddush. Mainly, he wants to say what he wants to say. But he says, don't bring me that medrash that the Rambam brought as a proof, because it's berach, He wanted to say some nice things about the number, so it didn't come out, exactly, so no big deal, With gematrias, you can be off by one, it's also a gematria, nobody lost any sleep over that. So that's basically what he's saying. And his listing of 613, by the way, I'm not even sure it hits 600. According to Rabach, I think it ends up at 595. The way he counts, because it all has to do with policy. You take the psukim in the Torah, and you have to figure out which pasuk is telling me it's a mitzvah, and which mitzvah, which carries component parts, become individual mitzvot. And that's really the root of the disputes between Rambam and Ramban, and then later on, the Sefer Mitzvot Gadol, and Sefer Mitzvot Katan, and Sefer Yireim, and Rav Sadigon, and everybody else, because they have different editorial policies of how to count. And if you want to end up at 613, then you're going to have to do some intellectual gymnastics at the end of the day. If you think that Yeshuva Aretz is one of the 613, and as the Ramban does, but that's going to give him an extra mitzvah in the Rambam's list, because Rambam didn't count it for whatever reason, then you're going to have to find something to take off. Or you're going to have to combine mitzvot, as we already pointed out. Is the Kriyat Shema in the morning, Kriyat Shema at night, is it one mitzvah, two mitzvot? Rambam says it's one, the Ramban says it's two. Is Kiddush HaChodesh and Ibur HaShana one mitzvah, two mitzvot? The Rambam says it's one, the Ramban says it's two. Is Korban Tamid Shel Shachar and Korban Tamid Shel Bein Abayim, the morning sacrifice in Beit HaMikdash and the afternoon sacrifice, is it counted as one mitzvah, two? Rambam says it's one, Ramban says it's two. Is executing by the four modes of execution in Beit Din, Skila, Sreif, Erech, Henek. Is that one mitzvah? Is that four mitzvot? So Rambam counts it as four, and Ramban counts it as one. So you see that there are different ways of how to handle this. And certain psukim, the Ramban thinks is a mitzvah, and the Rambam says, no, it's too general, it's not a mitzvah, and so on. Yet they both come up to 613 at the end of the day by the way they're counting. Rabach is not concerned about breaking his head that it comes up to be 613 at the end of the day. It's actually fascinating that a person of his caliber would make that statement. And it's only because the Rambam and the Ramban at the end of the day agree that 613 is certainly Misinai, and the author of the Sefer Chinuch, who is a student of the Ramban, yet he adopts the Rambam's listing, And this becomes immensely popular. We grew up on the number 613. It became really axiomatic and unchallenged. And then, you know, you read something like this. You know, you think it's some reform rabbi of the 19th century speaking. It's not. It's the Rabban, one of the great, 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 great commentaries on Tanakh. So why is he not as popular as the others? Aleph, they didn't print it in the Mikraot Gedolot. You know, what gets printed on the page becomes popular. And the question is, why did they print this and not that? That's a history also, by the way. How come in the Shas, the Vilna Shas, you have Rashi on one side and the authors of the Tosfot on the other side? That's all Ashkenaz. Hey, what happened to the Sfaradim? What happened to the Chiddush HaRamban? Why didn't they print that on the page? Why do you have to go to a Sfarim store and buy a Chiddush HaRamban and Chiddush HaRashba for these Sfaradi Gedolim? Why do you have to do, why? Where do you think they printed this? They didn't print it in Spain, it's printed in Europe. They printed in Europe and they were based on manuscripts of Ashkenaz. So that was the Torah that they learned. They learned Torah Ashkenaz. So that became on the page. Then when printing houses started competing with each other, so they started printing others in the back. In the back. They printed the Rosh, they printed the Riff. Fine, they added on things. So, until each one was competing with the other, you know, my Shas has this and that, this and that, this and that, that the others don't have. And subsequently, every edition would include all of that, plus more. And so on. So too with Rambam's, the Shabda Franco Rambam, has everything that everybody else has, plus more. Because if it doesn't have everything that everybody else has, then you're not going to buy it. You know, so these are commercial considerations. And that has to be understood. Rabag was not studied and well in Ashkenaz. And if one is studied well in Ashkenaz, the printers didn't bother sticking it on the page of Mikraot Gedolot. Why wasn't it studied? As my daughter pointed out, because the Rabag integrates scientific material in his Perush. And most of the people didn't have a clue what he was talking about. They didn't know what he was talking about. Mamashkar. Because you have to be a scientist to understand Rabag, his simple perush on Chumash and on Navi. You have to know what he's talking about. You have to know the language, the jargon of the scientist of the 13th century. Not only the words, the concepts, the scientific message, what he's trying to say. And what's fascinating, this is actually a chidush of my daughter, that when the Rabag wrote science, and he wrote scientific works, he sometimes will say, Kemoshe Katuv, as it says in Mishle, as it says in Tillim, and so on. He will take a scientific understanding and then go back to the Tanakh and say, you see, David HaMelech knew about this, Shlomo HaMelech knew about this, and so on. And vice versa. When he's explaining a pasuk in Tillim or in Mishle that has scientific import, he will explain the pasuk in terms of the science. So the Rabag is working on two frequencies simultaneously with an interchange. He's working science, he's working Tanakh, and he's crisscrossing all the time, which is phenomenal. So a person who's not aware of that fact is also going to miss the point. Because if you want to know what the Rabag had in mind when he explains the Pasuk scientifically, you better check out what he wrote in his science books on that matter. And then you'll fully appreciate what he's saying. If you don't do that, read my daughter's dissertation, okay? It's called The Biology of Rabag. Yeah?
What's so important about the number?
The number?
Why is there such a discussion about it?
That's a very good point. His name is Crumbine, wants to know what's so important about the number. The number. But first of all, let's assume 613 is definite, the way the Rambam has it. So then you know that you know that it's compact. It has a beginning, it has an end, and it's not that something that we can lose sight of. It's not something, Torah didn't give us something that's beyond our ability to handle. It's a number that's within reason, that a person who's a practicing Jew, in the context of Am Yisrael together, with Beit HaMikdash up and running, we can function within that number. If there would be no number, it could lead to expansion that would be beyond the scope of what the Torah wanted. And that's something which could be potentially dangerous. You have to be careful. That if you wouldn't have a number, so somebody would come up with a new mitzvah, and it would become a tradition, it would become a minhag already, and a minhag becomes a din, and it could be troublesome. It could be really, really troublesome, and it could take Judaism off the course. So having a definite number is certainly more than just useful, but it's really critical to maintain the balance of the Torah. That's for sure one of the good reasons. And The second is that numbers also is something that allows, is another realm of viewing the world. We view the world in terms of numbers. Days of the week, weeks of the year, months, and so on. The dates themselves have significance, very much they have significance. Dates, calendar dates, numerical values of quantitative values in fulfillment of mitzvahs, whether it was related to korbanot or whether it's eating matzah on Seder night, the number issue is an important issue. It puts Seder, it puts order into our lives, and it gives also, it formalizes the structure. So that is a very important reason that we teach kids numbers, because to get along in life without knowing the value of numbers is a serious handicap. It's a serious, serious handicap. And the Torah appreciates that very, very much so. So even within the realm of Torah, there are numbers. That's why when the Rambam writes a book, he writes it according to number of chapters. In each chapter, the number of halachot. So we remember things. Today, I mean, the Shas that we have today, I'm not, is based on a photo offset of the third printing in Vilna. So today when you say, oh, it's Gemara Masechet Sanhedrin Daf Kuf, what does that mean? Everybody knows what it means, because everybody knows there's a page number, and that page number means something to people. The Rav once talked about two Gedolei Yisrael having a conversation with each other, and all they said was they threw out sources. And one said, you know, Chulin Kaf Bet Aver Aleph, and the other one said, Tosfot Avad Zorah Amud Gimel. And they all knew what they were talking about. They didn't have to quote the relevant passages and so on. So numbers is an address. It's something that's very important, very important. The question of gematria, someone gave me once a gift, the two books that are called gematria. It's truth is, it's totally useless today. It's useless because I have it on the computer. Now my computer, Barilan, gives me a gematria program. And if I take, if I want to give a bar mitzvah speech for a kid whose name is Aaron, so I just plug in the name Aaron, and I ask the computer, give me every pasuk in Tanakh that has the gematria Aaron. And give me any phrase in Tanakh that gematria Aaron. And then all of a sudden I pick. All right, so this phrase says that he's a ganef. I'm not going to use that. And the other pasuk says he's a tzaddik. That's a good one, you know. I mean, it's pick and choose. There were people who were brilliant, able to figure this out before computer technology, like the Balaturim. The Balaturim, the author of the Tur, he did this for his own birthday. It was a hobby of his. He was a brilliant kid, person as a child. And he figured out gematrius, and he gave it to himself as a bar mitzvah gift. He was 13 years old. The Baal Turim was a bar mitzvah gift of Rabbi Yaakov Ben Asher, the son of the Rosh. And so people were gifted. They were able to see quickly enough the possibilities, and they came up with connections. Today, it can be very, very haphazard. For example, Rashi says in the beginning of Bereishis, Bishvil Yisrael Shenikra Reishit, Reishit Bara, Bishvil HaTorah Shenikra Reishit, that the Torah was, the world was created just because of Torah. Everything else around it is incidental, is supportive, not incidental, is supportive. But the main purpose of Briyat Olam creation was Torah. Fine. So I noticed at the end of Parshat Bereishit, where Kadosh Baruch Hu is reacting against what has gone on in the world and is very rejecting this world and wants to destroy this world. So the Torah says that that God's talking to himself, that he's mitnachem, he's already taken back, he feels bad that barati, that I've created the world. Barati, bet reish aleph taf yud, gematria 613, that word. So the word barati, I have created, speaking about God, I have created, is the gematria 613. I didn't see that anywhere. I noticed it myself. Gematria. And it drives with the Bishvil HaTorah, Shenikra Reshit. Those are, you know, in Yiddish it's called Geschmack. It tastes good. It's good for Sudash Lishit after the herring. This is not the kind of stuff that you understand Torah through gematria. It's a little bit cherry on top at the end. It makes for a nice ending or for a nice drasha and so on. But it's not something that you would use to teach Torah through the agencies of gematria. That I wouldn't do. For sure not. Okay, so let's just backtrack now to source number 5 on top of the page. Top of the second page. That's the Rambam of Sefer Mitzvot, the book that we're studying. Mitzvah Hey, the source mitzvah, fifth mitzvah. Fifth mitzvah! I mean, it's pretty much on top of the list. And the fifth mitzvah is davening, once a day. Rambam believes that there's a biblical mitzvah to to turn to HaKadosh Baruch Hu in tefillah once a day. Rambam understands that Chachamim added the idea of three times a day. Fine, he understands that. But the mitzvah in its pristine form is to turn to HaKadosh Baruch Hu once a day, when? Whenever you want. Within 24 hours, pick yourself a minute, then you turn to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. What are you supposed to say? Whatever's on your mind. Every person has needs. And how do you do it? Well, there's a formula. First say a word of praise to God, then get to the point what you need, and then end off by saying thank you for what, you know, like thank you in advance type of thing, or thank you for everything else you've done for me in the past. That's all you can say in any language. That's a biblical format of tefillah. Now, Chachamim adopted that formula when they constructed the Shmoneh Esrei, because the first three brachot are Shevach, praise. The core from Atachonein until Shmei Tefillah is the Bakasha, is the petition. And then Mitzvah until the end of Shmoneh Esrei is the Hodayah, is the thanks. So that the Rambam believes that that formula is biblical. Shevach, Bakasha, Hodayah. Though that triangular formula is biblical, and the Gemara actually relates to this. It says, how do you know that before you daven you say Shevach? Shneimar, it says, Chayav Adam Lesader Shvacho Shel Makom V'Chakar Le'olam, not Chayav, Le'olam Yisader Adam Shvacho Shel Makom V'Chakar Yitpalel. You should always give the praise of God, and then you should get to the point and ask. Shneimar V'Etchanan Al Hashem V'Eita Hilemor Yisif Moshe Rabbeinu. First he starts buttering up God. Ata Chilota La'avot Et Abdecha Godlecha Yodcha Chazaka. You've done so much, Am Yisrael. We've seen all these great things, and now he gets to the point. Ebrana ve'eret aretz atov. I'd really like to go into the land. That's his point. That's his petition. Before he gets to it, he reflects about all the great things that HaKadosh Baruch Hu did for Am Yisrael in the past. So the Rambam says, you see, this is biblical. This is not something that Chachamim made up. The formula of how to approach God, and then at the tail end also, there's a source of the ending the tefillah with divrei hodaya, with thanksgiving. So this is a good message for Thanksgiving Day for this week, right? I remember in the yeshivas that I went to, they always would say, by us, Thanksgiving Day is every day. It's true. It's absolutely true. So we don't need one day for Thanksgiving Day. They used to say it also for Mother's Day. Right. Mother's Day, Father's Day, right? So here, you know, because Mother's Day and Father's Day were really a product of the card companies, the greeting cards. Right, the presents. Right. The presents. Right. We know that. So, of course, every shtick of America, we have to bring an aliyah. So, you already have Yom Ha'im. You have Yom Ha'im here, but we know we don't have Yom Ha'av. You know why? Because we have Chodesh Av. Black Friday, yeah, that's here. But the only thing is that Friday is more than 24 hours. It's in America, it's one day. It's Friday after Thanksgiving. But here, all the stores are ready. Black Friday. Chogegim. By us, Friday is not black. Friday is a great day. It's a great day. V'yarol kim et kol ha'shar asav v'nei tov ma'od v'yarev avok yom ha'shishi. It's a great day, yeah, Friday. No such thing as Black Friday. So the Rambam, in source number 5, I think we may have to, you know what, we're going to begin with this actually next week, but let me lay out what the issues are. The Rambam proves that there is a mitzvah of tefillah once a day from the concept of avodat Hashem, service of God. But then he has to answer a question. He himself says in one of the introductory 14 categories of policy that a pasuk that's of a general nature is not an individual mitzvah, like kedoshim to you. So if you say, ulavdo b'chol levavchem, serve God with all your heart, ve'bo te'avodu, these are general statements. How do you know that it's tefillah? And indeed, the Ramban argues that there is no such thing as tefillah once a day. The Ramban says, there is tefillah in the Torah, for sure, but it's crisis tefillah. I mentioned this last week. Crisis tefillah, you're in trouble. So one person can be davening 10 times a day, and one person once in 10 years. Because people have different crisis moments. It's very subjective. Now the Rambam also has crisis tefillah, except that he calls it by a different name, calls it ze'aka, shouting to God. And he talks about it not in the context of ilchot tefillah, but in the context of ilchot ta'aniyot. Ta'aniyot, fasting. He says that's called crisis tefillah, where it has to do with fasting also. But in tilchot tefillah, the Rambam says, from a biblical point of view, it's once a day. And because it does not carry a time framework, says the Rambam, it is not a time-bound mitzvah. It's mitzvah taseh shelo hazman grama. It's not a mitzvah time-bound. And therefore, says the Rambam, women are obligated biblically in tefillah. And here comes the $64,000 question. What does that mean? obligated once a day, or now that Chachamim slapped on three tefillot a day, obligated three times a day, or perhaps somewhat of a compromise, obligated twice a day, and that is Shacharit and Mincha, because Ma'ariv was an issue, whether it was obligatory or mandatory, and the Rambam paskins that it's, whether it's obligatory or voluntary, Chova or Rishut, the Rambam decides in accordance with the view that it's voluntary, but Am Yisrael took upon itself as a minag to daven Ma'ariv. And the question is whether women ever took upon themselves this minag. That's the issue. So you have a tripod machloket as to what the obligations for women are in tefillah, whether it's once a day, whether it's twice a day, whether it's three times a day, and you know, choice D in the multiple choice is all of the above, right? So all of the above are true. You just have to know who said what. So we try to make some sense out of this next week. And I'm sure whatever you're doing, you know, ladies, you're doing okay because you have somebody to rely on and so on. But there's no... with tefillah, by the way, there's no bal tosif. Person can daven as much as you want. That's halavai sheyitpalel adam kol hayom kulo. There's no thing as excessive unless it's compulsory, obsessive behavior. Compulsive behavior, which I have seen. That is not religiosity. That's illness. And I've seen it with teenagers. We see a guy say Kriyat Shema 15 times, because he's not sure if he said Kriyat Shema with the right kavana, or I heard somebody say Aleinu Shabbat once 20 times. He wasn't sure he said it right. There, you know, instead of lauding the kid for excessive tzidkus, I would call a psychiatrist. I'm serious about this. I had this. I dealt with this in schools. That's obsessive compulsive behavior, and which sometimes expresses itself with religious action. By the way, in areas of kashrut, in areas of Tarat HaMishpacha, I'm telling you, I've seen it all, in terms of being obsessive-compulsive. And this is not, frumkeit, it's sickness. And sometimes people even know that it's sickness, but you have to deal with it. You certainly can't make fun of it, you can't poke fun. You have to deal with it as an illness. But we will talk about next week, about the idea of Avodat Hashem, how the Rambam understands this, how he includes the mitzvah of Talmud Torah into the same framework of tefillah, of Avodat Hashem, and something about the unique place of davening when you're in the close proximity of Beit HaMikdash, and why essentially we face Yerushalayim when we daven. It's all part of this 5-6 lines there of this Rambam. Okay? So, you can keep the pages, and I'm going to print another page next week that will begin with this source and then branch out to other sources. Okay. Shalom Aleichem.
You're right.
Last night, at 6:45.
How was the connection?
I gave my 8 o'clock cheer.
Oh, this.
I gave a shiur.